Street Smart podcast, back again with this time Bill Ellison, my neighbor, who just till recently I didn't even think about for some reason. And Bill was kind enough to open up his offices to us with the coolest backdrop to date, a 1929 Rolls Royce, one of one.
Phantom P1.
And this is Bill's car. Of how many cars do you have, just to get that out of the way?
I don't know, 15, 16, something like that.
Too many. And none of them are just your like average Hyundai. He's got some pretty elaborate rides.
Those are our other cars.
That's
not including our other car, our dailies.
That's right. The everyday drivers are one thing, but he's got some pretty amazing vehicles, some very unique vehicles. But Bill also has a very unique story. And I know some of it already just because I've known Bill now about 4 years. But more than that, it'll be really interesting to hear sort of the ins and outs of it. So, Bill, thanks for being a part of this.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, how did we get here? Where'd you start out?
How did you and I get here today?
No. How did we get here talking to Bill, successful owner of a housing, a construction company?
So, came from nothing. Came from absolutely nothing. From broken family. Don't know who my father is. We were homeless when I was 8, 9 years old, literally living in an abandoned motel, stealing power from a neighbor to run a refrigerator and a couple lights. On the weekends, standing in line at the church for the free powdered milk, bread, and cheese. A lot of people don't know that government cheese or what free cheese tastes like.
Yeah.
Or that they even made powdered milk. There's a lot of people who don't know that. They do.
And where was this?
All over in this kind of this area, but okay. I grew up in Alvin.
Okay.
We were in Baycliff whenever we were living in the abandoned motel.
Okay.
That's where we were.
But you're from this area, the Houston area.
Houston area, correct. Yeah. So then, from there to, I was in foster care for a period of time when I was 13 years old. That was kind of a pivoting moment in my life that I didn't want to live like I'd been living.
Sure.
And then when I was 16 years old, had a disagreement with, let's call it a disagreement with my mother's husband, walked out and never went back.
Okay.
And so now I've been, basically on my own, since then.
Since 16?
I'm 51 today. So, 35 years.
Is your birthday today?
No.
Okay. You're saying right now, today, you're 51.
51. Yeah. At this time, I'm 51.
Got it.
So
you were in foster care when you were 13, and then at some point between 13 and 16, you were reunited with your mother, and now she's got a new husband, disagreement, and you said, I'm gone.
Yeah, she was already married to him. He was the reason I was in foster care.
Oh, I got you.
He actually beat me half to death with a horse bridle, and when he did that, I ran away to a nearby store, and they called the police, and the police came and picked me up, and they took me away.
Wow.
And so then, after a period of time, I was in a group home where there's a bunch of kids, and you're all sleeping in bunk beds piled in, 6 or 8 kids into one room. And I just got tired of being there and wanted to be back with my family.
Sure.
And so I ran away. And whenever I ran away, then I became a runaway, completely different deal. Now, remind you, this is 1984. This was quite some time ago.
Sure.
And so during that time, things were way different. So when the police caught me, because that's the only thing they could do, is, hey, call the police. We've got this kid that's supposed to be in the care of the state, in CPS care, Child Protective Services care, is run away. So, excuse me, when the police caught up to me and took me back to the police station, the Texas Department of Family Services wouldn't take me back because I was then a runaway.
Mm-hmm.
And so they called my mother and said, okay, what do you want us to do with him? And she said, I don't know, just keep him.
Oh, wow.
So guess where I spent the night? And I spent the night in jail at 13 years old.
At 13.
Because they had nowhere else to put me.
Wow.
So during the day, this was in the afternoon, but during the day they had the door open to the jail. But then at night, for my protection, because I'm in there with a bunch of men.
Of grown men, correct.
And in case that anything were to happen, they had to shut the door.
Wow.
And so I spent the night in jail at 13 years old, and that was the exact moment that I said, I'm not going to live my life this way. And it took a little while, obviously, at 13.
You're right. That's right.
Kind of difficult to move out at that point.
You also didn't found a business at 13, but you decided at that moment, this is not my life trajectory. It's not going to be this.
I'm not going to allow it to be this,
yeah,
right? And so that was a pivoting moment in my life that said, I don't want to live like this. Took me a little while, but then when I turned 16, or when I was 16, I was almost 17. It was like, I'm going to call it March, and a couple months later, I was going to turn 17, 2 or 3 months later. And I actually had to go and get a fake ID. I went to the Pearland Flea Market, and they made me a fake Colorado driver's license. These were easy to get back then.
But there weren't a lot of systems in place for them to check whether that was valid or not. If it looked good, it was good.
Yeah, exactly. Right. If it looked legit, it was legit.
It was legit.
And it wasn't an in-state. So
sure.
Even then, it would take a police or anybody to run it. It takes a lot longer to run an out-of-state license than it does something local.
Right. And even back then, good grief. Who knows?
So, and I got a fake ID saying I was 18, but not so I could go out drinking or partying or doing anything like that, but so I could rent an apartment.
Gotcha.
Because they wouldn't rent me an apartment at 16 years old or 17 years old. And so I had to get this fake ID, and then I was able to rent my first apartment.
Nice.
So this was the end of my junior year in high school. I started my senior year. Now I'm living on my own. I'm working 3 jobs, and I'm going to school.
Going to school, yeah.
So I went to school in the morning from, call it 7 to noon, 7:30 till 11:30 or 12, whatever it was, a few hours in school. I was in a vocational program. Business information processing. So then I drove an hour to Clear Lake every day from Alvin to Clear Lake, drove an hour, and worked at IBM from 1 till 5 during the week. And then I turned around and drove an hour back and worked at a place called Monterey House, Monterey's Tex-Mex Cafe today, that I worked there from 6 till 10, 11, 12 at night, 5 to 7 nights a week. And then on the weekends, whenever I wasn't working at the Mexican restaurant, then I was delivering pizzas on the weekend. So I did nothing but work, and obviously from that to where I am today gave my work ethic and what I needed to do in order to survive to where I am today, that still I just grind every day. Everything is an important, not that everything's an emergency, everything is much more manageable today, but everything is definitely priority and important to take care of. My email box is clean at the end of the day, my phone calls are returned, all the things that I have to be done have to be done immediately. It's not a procrastination. You can't get to this level of success by any means and be a procrastinator.
No, and I've had those conversations with people and with my kids that at a certain point in your career path or a certain station in life, you get to a point where time it sort of doesn't matter. Only the commitment matters. So if I can finish the commitment in an hour, great. If I choose to do something else and then I have to come back to that commitment didn't go away. So that time is going to be spent no matter what. If it takes me 2 days to finish it, if my commitment is to you, I'm going to have this by the end of the week, you'll get it. I might have to grind myself into a powder to get there, but that's the commitment and that's what we do. So you're exactly right. And so I find it interesting that at 13 you said, I'm not doing this. And then at 16, you had the work ethic of somebody that years ahead of where you should have been. So at 16, you do that for a while, and then after that, then what?
So I finished high school, and worked 3 jobs until I could only work 2, and then until I made enough money until I could only work 1. And for about 5 years out of high, so for a couple years there, my senior year in high school, and a year afterwards, I worked for IBM. Definitely learned a lot from there.
What did you do at IBM?
So I was in the data processing and technical support. So somebody would call on the phone and say, hey, I'm having a problem. This was when computers were first coming out.
Right. So everyone had problems.
1988, 1990. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were self-inflicted problems. Okay,
they probably still are.
I've got my mouse on the screen and I can't figure out. And this little old lady has physically got her mouse on the screen trying to figure it out. Another one that I make light of is that, back in the day we had these 5 1/4 floppy disks.
Oh yeah, man.
Okay. So then somebody called in and said, yeah, I keep saying put the next one in. I've got like 5 in there.
Oh.
They're sitting there crushing, putting, if you recall the way those things were.
Yeah. They went in and then kind of dropped a little bit.
Right.
And then you had to eject them. Yeah. And
you had to eject the other one first.
Correct.
Well, there's some people just didn't realize that. Again, this was.
They were ahead of their time. They were looking for those disk changer.
looking for something
floppy drives.
What today's technology is, just,
right?
All you do is plug a data port in.
Correct, if that, or just download it out of the cloud. So, so you were doing customer support. So that had to be something that helped you now, being able to deal with your clientele.
So working at IBM helped me considerably,
yeah,
because I can stand here and have a conversation. I can look somebody in the eye, can give them a great handshake, and have an appropriate conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot whenever I worked there about professionalism, how to act and so forth, rather than being from the trailer and being from the streets that I knew nothing about. And it's funny because you go back and look at videos and things that were done back then of me,
mm-hmm,
and listen to me then and listen to me today, I sound like some East Texas hillbilly, back then, and we laugh about it, today,
sure,
because
sure,
such a transition, that I've made over the years, and professionalism and the way that I speak, the words that I use,
sure,
and so forth.
Sure.
We all grow, but it was
right.
to look back at this, it's comical. It's quite comical.
So I'm gonna have to get my hands on some of those videos now that you said that they exist. So. You go through this process. Now you're working at IBM. How long were you at IBM?
My senior year in high school, and for a year afterwards.
Okay.
And then after that, I got hired by a company to travel, well, in their data processing department initially. And eventually I took over all their training, and I traveled all over the United States setting up and installing their computer systems for them for an environmental company.
Oh, wow.
And so for 5 years I did that. And then I got the opportunity to go into new home sales. And of course, the person that introduced me and said, "Hey, you need to go do this. You've got the gift of gab.
Sure.
Can create relationships. You can talk to anybody."
Sure.
Sales. I don't know about sales. That's scary to me. I've never done anything like that.
Right.
And so I went and started selling new homes. I did very, very well, for about 4 years. And then I got one comment on a comment card that said that this older gentleman knew more about construction than this young sales guy. Now I'm 26 something, 26, 27.
Sure.
Around that. So yeah, he's in his 40s or something. He probably does know more about construction than what I did. But I took that as a learning experience. And when I was finished selling in that community, the home builder that I was working for didn't have another spot for me. And so I took that opportunity to go to work for a different home builder and went actually building houses for him rather than selling them.
Gotcha.
Just so I could learn how.
Right.
I took a huge pay cut. I took like a two-thirds pay cut.
Wow.
in order to go and do that job. But I did it for about 2 years, did it very, very well. And then in 2001, I went out on my own and started my first construction company. And I'd paint that wall for a candy bar. I wasn't going back to work for somebody else.
That's right. That's right.
So, and that's, so then started my construction company at that point. It was actually a roofing company. And my "while you're here" business got in the way. While you're here, the roof leaked and it damaged my sheetrock.
Right.
And while you're here, it also damaged my cabinets or my carpet or whatever.
Right.
My "while you're here" became a full-on blown remodeling company.
Right.
So then that turned into the $1,000 job, turned into the $10,000 job, turned into the $1 million job. And I was very well known with some affluent people in the Houston surrounding area of the guy to go to whenever you needed a high-end job done. And so when you need that multi-million dollar job done, you
sure.
call Bill. And you didn't call me to bid the job, you called me to do the job.
Yeah, there was no bid. It was
no,
just come
no
do
kid.
The job.
That's right.
So at what point, you're working for what I would call a W-2 job, right? So you're working for other companies and successful in all of those. What got you over the hump of, hey, you know what, I'm going to do my own thing?
So a combination of things. Obviously, without my wife Colleen, there's no way it would have ever happened.
Right.
Definitely had the full support from her in order to be able to do that. She had a great job that she had, and so there was a comfort level there, mm-hmm, that said, okay, I can step out and do this. We don't have to have everything, all the resources from two incomes. I can go out and get this deal started and
sure.
get it ramped up. It would be not unlike someone. Supporting someone while they're going to school.
Sure.
One person's going to college, the other person's working, and eventually it all works out.
Right.
And now today, 24 years later that we've been together, 23 years of marriage in 30 days, that we're, we do very, very well.
Yeah, absolutely. So were you ever hesitant? Did you say, man, what's going to happen? I don't know there's a lot of unknowns when you go to start a business. And what's always kept me from really kind of pulling that trigger is similar to what you were just describing. And not that to discount what my wife does on a daily. She's busy, busy and taking care of all kinds of things. Definitely taking care of me, which is for sure more than a full-time job. But she doesn't have an income-producing job. For me to say, all right, I'm just going to pull out all stops and start my own thing would be a huge risk. So I'm sure there were still reservations, even though you had that sort of comfort level. What were they and how'd you get through them?
So I'm not sure that there was ever a reservation about it, but there's definitely uncomfortable.
Sure.
And so even today, what I tell people is if you're not stressing, you're not growing. Okay. Mm-hmm. And let that sink in just for a second.
Yeah.
Right. If you're comfortable, then you're probably stagnant. You know, you're probably just surviving. You're
right.
Just kind of being there is what you're doing. Rather than me on the daily, I'm okay, now what do I do? Now what
right.
do I do to do better? Now what do I do to get better? Now what do I do to make more money? Now what do I do to better my life, to better my family, or whatever it may be?
Sure.
And now that makes you uncomfortable, right? Just sitting here talking, you're probably feeling kind of the antsiness of my power, the motivation that I've got.
Right.
And that's the way it is. And it's infectious to everyone around me. The more that, you know, I have these kind of conversations and have these kind of interviews and so forth, for me to be able to help others to understand, if you're just sitting here working as a secretary, you know, at a, you know, 8-to-5 job, you're probably not ever going to get where you need to be. And so do you really want to be there? And how bad do you want it?
Oh, no,
sure. Everybody wants it bad. Oh, they want it so bad. They go get a second job.
Yeah.
Oh, well, no. I watch Game of Thrones at night. I can't do that. Okay. I sleep only 3 to 5 hours a night.
Yeah.
And then either Saturday or Sunday, I usually am able to relax a little bit and catch up on some of that. But it's grind and go
sure.
all the time.
Sure. Well, it's worked for you. And it works for, you know, a lot of people. And you're right. There are a lot of people out there that want that instant payout and that instant, man, hey, I'm going to start a business and I'm going to be a millionaire. And I think they would be shocked to learn how many people own businesses that, you know, they're making a good living, but they're not just, you know, balling out of control necessarily. So was there a period of time when you ramped up your first business that you were like, man, this is not going great? Or did it just right out of the gate, things were good?
No. at that time, things were going very well.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, there were some changes in what the type of business that I was doing, which is a lot of whether it was going out actually doing the remodeling, which some of the higher end remodels came later on. But during the earlier times in the first 5 years, which is the most difficult time,
sure.
I failed. I say I failed. I learned. I stumbled.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to go get a job. And so I went and worked at a job for a period of time just to have some income while I was still doing all my remodeling on the side. And that was definitely a time that I was like, man, I'm I hope I don't get stuck back at this.
Sure.
And then Hurricane Ike came in 2008.
Oh, wow.
Well, then that turned around and the phone was just ringing off the hook.
Right.
At that point.
On the remodel side.
On the remodel side.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was able to forego the job. The job was only about 6 or 8 months long. It wasn't a very, very long period of time.
What an interesting lesson too, though, that you were willing to do that to supplement your life you had to do that.
Lifestyle.
And then at the same time saying, you know, I'm not just going to jump ship, abandon this concept, this idea, this company that I've started. There's something still there. I just need a little breathing room so I can properly focus on that, right? Because if you're always, in my experience, if I'm always worried about, that's what's always kept me out of like a true sales role, is just that transactional nature of it. And like, man, I got to turn my lights on. I better make a sale type of thing. It is almost demotivating to me. Mm. And it can create a situation where I get up every day and I'm terrified. And that fear.
That's that uncomfortable.
Yeah, but that fear though, rather than, man, I need to go out, it compromises my ability to do the job.
Hmm.
So for me, I've always told people, yeah, I'll do whatever you want me to sell, you want me to do whatever, fine. Pay me a good salary and I'll kill myself to do it just because I like to win. And so I think it's interesting that you went and got another job so that you could, you know, supplement your lifestyle. And was any of that in response to, man, I have to do this so that you could properly focus on the other one? Or was it just simply, man, I've just got to close some gaps here?
No, it was simply financially motivated.
Yeah, yeah.
No strategy other than that.
Yeah.
It was just, once you start gaining a lifestyle, you want to maintain that lifestyle.
Yeah, you don't want to go backwards.
I couldn't go to, you know, 4 large jobs a year when I was doing 20 large jobs a year before.
Right.
Right?
That's
right. So going to 4, I'm like, okay, I need some supplemental income, basically is what I did.
That's right.
And so went to work for a short period of time, and then, you know, everything turned around in 2008. So that's when things really started moving from on the higher mm-hmm. jobs. So went from, you know, I'm going to call it a $200,000 or $300,000 job to a multi-million dollar remodel job. And then I'm with you for 12 to 18 months,
yeah.
You know, living at your home with you for a long period of time.
Yeah.
Some of them were shorter.
Figuratively living.
Figuratively. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a really interesting business model. Hey, we're going to move in. I need extra room.
Well, you know, you figure that when you've got somebody that you're remodeling their home, mm-hmm. you're living with them.
You're there.
You intimately know them.
For sure.
I mean, you know, quite honestly. You know, I'm there for a long period of time, and that's a long, drawn-out process as well,
right?
And I wasn't the guy who walked up and said, okay, hey, I need some money up front to do my job. I always said, I don't need any of your money up front.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does that do? Now you trust me,
right?
Because I'm not walking up saying, hey, I need $100,000, and you don't know if I'm going to walk away or not.
Right.
Versus I'm saying, hey, let me get a little bit into this, and let me get some work done. When I need some money, I'll come and let you know.
Right.
And so there's obviously some stress in that piece of it. But man, doesn't that create a bond between me and you that you trust me because I'm not going to run off with your money?
Yeah, it does. And you know, so many times you see, especially in construction, you see a lot of, you know, I need some upfront costs, and then they just bounce on the project, right? So it does two things in my mind. If I'm in your shoes, one, it creates a bond and a trust, and two, it allows the person to see some of your work, and then say, man, can you do this and this and this? And so. Hopefully that's what you saw, was people, you know, adding on to the project as you were going.
Yeah, so, and that's, you know, going back to my while you're here business, mm-hmm. you know, that's what that turned out to be. I'll give you a great example, one that a commercial job that we did that was a $200,000 tile job for United Airlines over in Austin and San Antonio. That turned into a $2.5 million job because I got in, they're like, well, can you do this and can you do this? And sure, we can do whatever you want to do.
Whatever, yeah.
And so, you know, that grew into a much larger opportunity.
That's awesome. And so you're doing these remodels, and that sort of leads into my next question. How much of what you were doing was commercial versus residential?
About 20% was commercial, 80% was residential.
So the majority is residential.
So the majority was all residential because it pays better, it pays very well, but it also pays a lot quicker.
Sure.
Commercial jobs can be, you know, 90, 120 longer periods of time out. In order to actually collect on those.
Yeah, and so the personal relationship then is much more critical.
Absolutely.
When you're doing residential. And so that lends more credibility to the way that you're doing it. You know, go in and say, no, I don't need anything right now. Let's just get started.
Yeah.
And that's refreshing. I've yet to come across anyone construction-wise that's that way. That ever burn you?
No. No. I'm sorry. On little dollars,
sure.
Little dollars, it didn't matter. So I say, sure. No, it didn't burn me. It really didn't. You know, there were, you know, little $1,000 here, $1,000 sure. there. That's kind of irrelevant.
Did you do anything to insulate yourself from that? Or was it just, man, I trust you're going to pay me?
No, I mean, there were times that I had contracts, but I've done multi-million dollar deals on a handshake.
That's awesome.
Literally walk up, shake somebody's hand. Yes, I'll be back tomorrow. Kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, it's not the practical way to do business.
Yeah.
But 100%, I was the best that anybody could. I was hands down the best contractor out there whenever it came to that.
Yeah.
And over time, I just figured out that, you know, from that standpoint, I just really don't like dealing with rich people's problems.
Mm.
So that's just a different level of problems that they're used to dealing with.
Right.
And so then when it comes to their personal home, 100% the quality will be there, but the nitpickiness and the attitude of that and that entitlement attitude is what I really didn't like.
Sure.
And so because of where I came from, where my past was, I didn't handle those situations very lightly internally, just internally, not to
right.
I never got into it with a customer or did any kind of, you know, problems like that, but just internally I didn't handle it.
It just kind of chewed you up on the inside a little bit.
It did. And yeah. So, you know, it stained me is what it did. And then I had several years later, then I had some builders come to me and said, Bill, you hear that you do these, you know, really great backyards. You got all these, you know, $200,000 outdoor kitchens that you're doing, all this kind of stuff. We just need some plug and play. We need, you know, a 4, 6, 8, 10, 12 foot, some stuff we can just plug and play.
Yeah, some modular type design.
That basic setup. And so that turned into a full-on business model. That turned into one owner, one location, the largest outdoor kitchen company in the entire United States, doing 30-some-odd builders across Houston. And I was the guy when it came to any kind of an outdoor luxury living that called Bill. The Greater Houston Builders Association, Texas Association of Builders. If somebody had something about an outdoor kitchen, outdoor living, call Bill. And so that became a full-on business model, which phased out all the higher-end remodels because I have a repeatable business model now. I got a particular size kitchen, 4, 6, 8, 10. You call up or the builder sends a PO over, I need this 8-foot kitchen on this back patio. My guys went out, they installed it.
Yeah.
I didn't have to show up unless there was some kind of an issue.
Sure.
And then, you know, over time, FaceTime comes out. Now I don't have to drive across town.
Yeah.
My guy can FaceTime me and he can turn around and show me, look, here's what I'm dealing with.
Oh, wow.
And I can walk him through. And then if there's becomes an issue, then I'll have to drive across town. And so we did that for several years. And we had one of the key things that we did was, or that I did, that I implemented was a checklist for quality assurance. And so in the last 3.5-4 years of me doing the outdoor kitchens, I had zero warranty issues.
That's
zero.
Great.
Not one, not two, zero warranty issues.
And how many years?
In the final, so we did that for about 6 or 7 years that we did the outdoor kitchens. In the final 4 years, zero warranty calls.
So the majority of your business, zero warranty calls. That's
zero,
amazing.
Zero. Now there was, hey, my grill, the light's not coming on, stuff. Well, I call the manufacturer. The manufacturer sends a rep out. They repair it. It's off me.
Now, you didn't build that grill.
I didn't build that grill.
That's right.
Right? And so the burner wouldn't start correctly or whatever. Well, the plumber, you know, put the wrong fitting in, or the, you know, whatever it might be, that it's a manufacturer issue and not a Bill's quality issue.
Right.
And everyone understood that. So, and then my welder who welded my boxes for me, he came to me and said, "Hey, Bill, I need to borrow some money." I said, "Well, man, I don't lend money, but you know."
Sure.
And he says, "Well, I got these 3 lots over here that I'll sell you really cheap." I went out and looked at the lots and said, "Okay, I could probably double my money on the deal." I bought the lots from him, paid him, got the deeds to the land, and then 6 months later, the lots didn't sell. So I said, "I'll just start some houses on it."
Right.
Well, that went from my first 3 houses to we'll do a little over 300 homes this year. We'll do over 600 next year in new homes, and it's all an affordable home.
Right.
We start out about $120,000 homes on a slab, 100% name brand products, 100% quality, 100% inspections, all engineered, everything. It's 100% on the up and up, no shanty, you know, nonsense building, last window at Lowe's, plug it
right,
in.
That's right.
Kind of thing that we do like that.
And that's a unique model, and I'm glad that we're getting to that because it's something that, you know, when you and I went out to that one subdivision out north of the lake there, or west of the lake, sorry. That was unique. I mean, the houses were, they're nice homes. They're small, obviously. You know, they're starter type homes, but they don't look like a starter home. They look like what, you know, what's something I would want to live in, right? They look great. They're great. And so how did you get to that business model and what made you decide, hey man, there's a gap in the market. How'd you identify that gap in the market and know to put your resources there and your attention there?
So when I had those first 3 lots, I looked around at a survey of the entire Houston surrounding area. I said, who's the cheapest builder out there? Who's the least expensive builder out there? What's the price point? At that time in 2016, it was $140,000 home. There was 3 or 4 builders that were building in that lower price point. And so I said, okay, I want to be under these those guys because I don't want to compete with those guys.
Right.
Those guys either got Dubai money or they've got big public money or whatever.
They've got some money somewhere to they have access to some resources.
I had bill money. I
had bill money.
I had what was in this pocket right here, and it's maybe a little bit that might have been held over here.
You had bill dollar bills.
So I looked around. And I said, okay, I'm going to build a more affordable home than what these other guys are because I got zero overhead. It's just very, very little overhead and so forth. And so I went out and just picked some smaller product. Mm-hmm. And once I picked that smaller product, then over time I realized, wow, there's a true need for this. So my first three houses, they were at 140. I did 125, 135, and 145, those first three houses. The 125 and 135, I didn't even cut the first blade of grass and those two houses sold before I could even start building them, before I could even get permits.
Yeah.
And then by frame, I sold the third one. And I said, I've got something here.
Some here, yeah.
There's something to be said for this. So I look around a little bit more. I look around. I said, man, there's nobody out there really doing a truly affordable home. And, at this point, prices start to go up just a little bit. Next thing you know, $140,000 house, a $200,000 house.
Sure.
And then we were still doing, 120s to 200 price point.
Sure.
So I'm still underneath what everybody else was. I'm not competing with those guys.
It's a different product.
It's a similar but smaller.
Correct.
Okay. And so while you or I may not live in that house because it's a smaller home, the person that's buying that's their castle, man.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's absolutely. And they're not walking around like this because they live in an apartment. They're walking around with their head up and their shoulders back because they're proud and they're a homeowner. And so the size of the home.
And they're not walking around in a home they bought it's a constant problem either.
No.
Because they had to buy something they could afford.
So oftentimes I tell people, it's like, look, you have to start with the Kia with no air condition, which will resolute with you and I from back in the day when Kia first started and they had a $4,000 no air conditioned car.
It definitely was not for Houston drivers.
But there was a market for it.
Absolutely.
And then look at what Kia is today.
That's right.
And I'm not endorsing the brand. I'm just saying that in general, they build a much nicer car today.
I rented a Kia a while back. It was a pretty nice ride.
Yeah.
It wasn't bad.
They're very nice.
Yeah.
So, and just over time, that's what we've done. So I've researched, we travel abroad quite often and was in Scotland a few years ago, about 3 years ago, and I found how efficiently they live over there. Mm. And they had some smaller homes that were a little 600 square foot, two bedroom, one bath home. Well, that's the size of an apartment. People are living in that all the time. Why can't I build a single family house like that?
Sure.
And make it very, very affordable. And so now today, that's what we do, and we're very successful. We're the best in the business at it.
Yeah, it's like I said, a very unique business model, and it's interesting to me too because it's gone from, okay, I've got these three lots, and let's put up some houses at different price points and see what happens, to now you're going in and you're buying larger tracts of land and fully developing neighborhoods, right?
So we started out with those three lots, and then beyond that, I would go into that same neighborhood and I would go out and then buy the remnant inventory or leftover lots or a lot maybe someone bought and, grandma gave it to them or whatever and they don't want it anymore. They don't want to pay the taxes, homeowner association, whatever. And so I'd buy up all the remnant inventory of the orphan lots and we were building in there. And then we took the next step and we started buying into developments where someone was putting the roads and streets and mm-hmm. everything else in a brand new development and we would go in and start building in there. And now we've taken a step further, and I buy the virgin land, and I knock the trees down, and we put the streets in, we put all the infrastructure, all the underground utilities. We do 100% of from the horizontal construction all the way through the vertical and the home building construction.
That's amazing. And all of those things, when you look back to the first business you started, those have just built on one another. And it seems like if I was to draw a through line, it's just a, like you said, a constant quest to be uncomfortable, number one. And then number two, just a constant quest for, knowledge and education, like being over in Scotland and recognizing, they're living like this. That translates to this potentially for me from a business standpoint. Have you always had that drive to learn and stay, one step ahead, keep yourself educated? Or was that a learned skill for some reason you realized I need that?
No, I think that someone like me, you just know that you can't stop, right? if I stop. So I give you a quick little for instance that I'm 35 years working at this point. So say from 16 until 51, it's 35 years yep. that I've been working right now. I could retire very, very comfortably today. But if I live to 85, 86, I got another 35 years to go. I'm only halfway there. So what would I do if I retired today for another half of my adult life? I would get old, fat, and die.
Well,
that's what I would do.
If I had to bet money on it, I would say buy cars.
I do that today, right?
So right, that's right.
I don't need to retire to do that.
I would say you would continue doing that.
But. So the point being is you can only do – I do that in my spare time.
Right.
Right? In my there's still a lot of other unoccupied time that I would have.
Absolutely.
And so I prefer to just keep working. There's nothing wrong with it. And I love what I do. It's not really work, quite honestly. It's managing processes is all that it really is.
You know, and listening to your, you know, it's when you talk a little bit off air, obviously, living in our neighborhood, I've talked several times. Your heart behind a lot of this is seeing people kind of get a good start in life. And that has to stem from your childhood, obviously. And then, you currently have children that you fostered and adopted. And it's just amazing to see you continue to give back and understand that, the heart behind your business model is truly to help people take that next step in life and continue growing their lives and getting and enriching their lives.
Definitely. So, my wife and I do a lot with various charity organizations, and majority centered around children.
True.
Children and children's needs and so forth. We were going to do stuff with the homeless and things, but we think they're kind of set in their ways at a certain point, and so that becomes a little bit more difficult, as well as there's some dangers that are in that, especially for my wife to be around and so forth.
Right.
So we focus on children, and if we can get in the hearts and minds of children and help them to understand that they don't have to stay in their circumstance.
Right.
They can get out of their circumstance, but they have to work at it. And if we can help to educate them and give them that knowledge to say, okay, look, I was where you are. Every kind of abuse that you've gone through, every kind of difficulties that you've gone through, I've done it. I have been there.
Right.
Well, I'm really not that smart. I've just worked harder than what the guy is next to me. And I've outworked whoever else that it was, and that's gotten me to the point that I am today. But to help children to understand, that's all they've got to do. Rather than stand there with their hand out mm-hmm. like this, mm-hmm. they need to stand there with their hand out like this, that they're going to go get it.
Right.
Right? And be more of a lion, to go out and get things rather than a sheep waiting to be
right.
fed.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right to try to tap into children and catch that mm-hmm. mindset before it gets too far the other way, where they get accustomed to, well, this is just my life now.
Yeah.
But I think that message also resonates with a lot of adults, and it will, for sure. And so, as we kind of round the corner now, how'd you get into collecting cars?
So, I've been a car guy my entire life. So my early cars were, junkers, but it was, a 69 Chevelle.
It was cool to you.
It was cool to me. And so I have that mindset that all cars are cool. I don't care if it's an 89 Honda. There's something that's cool about it. There's a feature that car has that was cool at that time,
mm-hmm.
Or a particular shape of that car that made it cool or whatever it might be. And so a lot of folks that get to my level of car collecting and so forth, they start to become a little snobbish. I'm not that way. It's literally any car show that I go to, I'm sitting there talking to virtually every different kind of a walk of life of somebody who owns different kinds of cars, because I'm a true car enthusiast.
Yeah.
So I've had all kinds of cars, and obviously the dream is always right to get there. What do you want? I want to get a Ferrari.
Yeah.
I want to get a Ferrari. Man, if I get a Ferrari, I'm there. I'm somebody.
I've done it.
Well, it's not all that.
Yeah.
There's a whole nother level beyond Ferrari. Yeah,
there's always levels.
But, and so it's I got my first Ferrari 10 or 12 years ago, and I drove it home, and my wife knew that I was looking at it, but she didn't know that I had picked one up. And so I came up, and I was in a F430 Spider, and drove it to my house that I live in now, and drove up and parked it and went inside. I said, oh, I got my Ferrari. I got, you know, I got the Ferrari.
Right.
She goes over, lifts up the blind, says, yep, it looks like a piece of metal with four wheels, and puts the blinds back down. I'm like,
oh, man,
what? Yeah. who does that?
Who even are you right now?
So she didn't particularly care for the car because,
first of all, it's not metal.
Well, that one was. But,
oh, well, okay. Fair enough.
But so anyway, it was a very flashy car.
Sure.
And so she didn't. She, you know, very much was of the opinion that, well, that, you know, that you're going to attract the women. The women are going to be all over you.
Yeah, this, well, that's what obviously why you be. Wanted it. It was bait.
And so, you know, I told her I had to help her understand. I said, no, Colleen, you don't understand. Who likes these cars are 4-year-old little boys to 98-year-old men.
Yep, dudes.
That's who like these cars.
Yep.
You go to any pretty much car show, 90% of the people that are there are men.
Yeah, every time you come down the street in your Aventador, and it's so loud, and I love every noise it makes. My wife's like, God, that car is so loud. I was like, well, it's a race car. It's supposed to be loud. But I mean, just being able to have a car like this, when we walked back here in the shop the other day, and I was like, I've never seen anything like that. That's awesome. And then behind that, what year is that Countach?
So that's a 1990 Countach.
1990 Countach. And I've had that poster in my room just like every other person that's around our, you know, in our generation for sure. And except mine was red and that one's white. And then just to my right is a Lamborghini motorcycle made by Ducati. And then just a basic run-of-the-mill Harley. But it's amazing. And what's your favorite car that you've ever had?
So all my cars have been special for a particular reason. But hands down, my favorite car that I currently have got, and out of all the cars that I've always had, is my Aventador.
Yeah, that thing is so sick.
My Aventador, it's a truly, truly wonderful, wonderful car. But you take a car like this. This is a 1929 Rolls-Royce Phantom P1.
Yeah.
This is a one-of-one car. The gentleman owned this, ordered it in a special size with certain features and so forth that made it a one-of-one car on the planet.
Right.
And so this car is an absolute work of art.
That's right.
And it's so beautiful. It's just hands down an absolutely beautiful car. And so it has a different reason for me to have it in my collection than what my Aventador does. Mm-hmm. Now, I drive this car. I go out and get on the road. Was on the freeway a few weeks ago driving to a car show at 80 miles an hour down I-45. Not a problem. I drive all my cars.
Yeah.
And so if I can't drive it, I'm not going to have it. So this is not a garage queen that, hey, come here. Let me show you in my garage what I've got. Right? No, I'm going to go out, going back to changing lives and things that we do. I'm going to go out. I'm going to go to car shows. And I'm going to let kids crawl all over my cars.
Yeah.
Inside of them. Get in, take pictures and everything else. Of course, then dad always wants to get in. I'm like, no, man, sorry.
Yeah.
Because dad's got a pen in his back pocket. He's got a knife. He's got a gun on his belt. He's going to scratch my leather. He's going to break. And then I'm going to be the jerk for getting onto him about it, right?
Right.
Kids don't. No. They're broke. Their pockets are empty.
That's right.
So I don't have to worry about
them. They might have sticky hands, but you can wipe that off.
That's okay, right?
Yeah, you can wipe that off.
But it'll also be something very special that they may remember, or they may start dreaming bigger later on. And so that's where a lot of it comes from the cars.
When I saw that Countach back there, I turned into a kid again. I was like, oh, my God, I've never seen one of those. What in the world? And it's so cool. I really enjoy seeing them. One of my favorite memories, it was a couple of years ago. I remember coming home from work. I turned on our street, and there was every Lamborghini I'd ever seen in my life. And there were a few Audis and stuff, but who cares? They were mostly Lamborghinis. And I guess there was a gathering or something down in Katy, and all of them were coming from various places and rolled into our neighborhood, and I hung out with you for a bit. And I remember just standing around the street looking at all of them, and you were like, yeah, that one there came from the museum in Italy, and that one this. And I was like, oh, my gosh. Those cars are they're amazing. And like you and I talked about, they're unique in that a Ferrari is a beautiful car. The lines on it are sexy lines. It's just a very sleek, beautiful car. But a Lamborghini is aggressive. It's a hyper-aggressive car, and man, I'm here for it. I like those a lot. But you have another Rolls-Royce that you actually drive. It's a what's it called?
So it's a Wraith. A Wraith.
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 Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a young gentleman's car is what it is.
It's amazing.
And it's the fastest production car that Rolls-Royce ever made. And then I tuned it even faster. So it's a really, really special car, too. And we've got some more cars that are coming over the next few.
Just so that I have it on recorded, how many horsepower is the Aventador?
The Aventador stock is about 700 horsepower.
Yeah, we're not worried about stock. What's yours pushing?
It's pushing about 9.
That's awesome. It's the only car I've ever been in where I thought, well, this will just never stop accelerating.
Yeah, it's a pretty lovely car. You'd like just moved in, too. You were like a week, I think. And I stopped by. I'm like, hey, you want to go for a ride?
Yeah, and I had to go ask permission because I was outside doing some stuff, and I had to go ask my wife. Hey,
I don't think you asked permission. I think you went in, and your wife turned to you and said, you're going for a ride, aren't you?
Well, she was watching out the window because she heard you coming.
It was an acknowledgement.
And she saw me running and skipping to the house and said, oh, I get it. But, no, it was awesome, man. Well, what is one piece of advice to that person out there that's sitting around thinking, man, I've got an idea. I think it'll work. What would you tell that person to help them say yes or no?
It's kind of hard to say because, you know, it depends on what the idea is.
Sure.
Right? If you're thinking about creating the next iPhone, man, that's a pretty tough gig. Right? If you're thinking about going up against Nike with a shoe, that's a pretty tough gig.
Yeah.
Now, if you're thinking about going into sales and depending on yourself, then go do it.
Yeah,
you know, if you're thinking about, going out and starting a construction company or whatever the company might be, maybe your background's IT, maybe your background is in the oil business, mm-hmm. and you say, man, I'm going to go out and get my own gig, right? Go do it. Depend on yourself and believe in yourself. Now, you may have a short period of time, you know, that you go out and you start doing, you say, oh, man, this just really isn't for me. After you've been on your own for a long time, you become unemployable. It's very difficult to be a business owner and then go back and work for somebody else because you're going to do things your way, mm-hmm. and people are going to say, oh, well, this is just a short period of time. He's going to go off and do his own gig again.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And so you become unemployable. Stay with it. Grind. There's not 8 hours in a day. There's 24 hours in a day. So if you got to work for 22 hours and sleep 2, how bad do you want it?
Yeah.
That's what it's going to depend on.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, like you said, if you're looking at something where you're betting on yourself, as long as you're willing to put in that work, you're going to be successful. I do believe that. I truly do. So,
like I said, I have people literally all the time, Bill, how do I get where you are? Well, they're not looking at the 35 years of grinding that I've done. They're looking at where I am today and what my current success is, mm-hmm. and they want to be, how do I get there tomorrow? Well, you plan today for what it's going to look like in 20, 30 years, kind of like investing. Right. You don't look at it today's investment necessarily. You're looking at what's it going to look like by the time I retire. That's what you want to look at. And so, you know, and I tell people what I mentioned it earlier was that if you really want it and you're not making it and you're 8 to 5, go get a second or third job. And if you really want it, you'll go do that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go do that, then come talk to me. Man, Bill, you're right. Man, my work ethic has changed. My status has changed because I'm making 3 times the money now.
Right, that's right.
Right? It's something as little as I'll tell a server, hey, instead of coming up and asking me after I'm already full at the end of my meal if I want dessert, ask me to order my dessert at the beginning of my meal.
When I'm still hungry.
When I'm still hungry. You'll increase how much your dessert sales are by 20-30%, as well as, guess what?
Increase your tip amount yep.
by that much as well, because now I'm ordering a $10 dessert.
Right.
That's an extra $2 in general on a tip. Times 20 people, times 100 days, all of a sudden, you've increased your income by 20% just by changing one thing.
Correct. And you're not altering what you're doing. You're changing the order in which you're doing it.
You're managing a process differently.
Yeah, I remember my first job I ever had was sacking groceries. So I was 16 years old at Albertsons in Midland, Texas. And one of the things that our manager said to me that stuck with me, still does, it was said, when you go to ask somebody if they need help with their groceries, don't go ask them if they need help with their groceries, because most people will tell you no. Go to them and say, let me help you with your groceries.
Yeah.
And they just will let you. And just that subtle, for whatever reason, when I was 16, that struck me as just that subtle nuance in how you're saying the same thing could mean the difference in being able to do something and not being able to do something. And so it's very similar to what you're saying. So
true enough.
I really appreciate your time. I know you said you have kind of a stop at 2, so we're coming up on that probably. But, man, it means the world to me to sit down and talk with people and hear their story and how they got there. And I really appreciate everything. And keep those cars coming down the street, man. Those things are cool to see. But more than that, I wish nothing but success and continued success for you and your family.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, man, absolutely. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks.
See you.